Public universities, like so much else in Illinois and around the world, have had to scramble in response to the novel coronavirus.
I'm confident that we'll get back to face-to-face instruction in the fall, assuming that we keep our responsible social distancing.
An interview with University of Illinois System President Tim Colleen. We talk about the university's response to COVID-19, the significant hit on its finances, and what comes next for higher education in an age of pandemic. Today is also the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. We'll be talking with two leaders of the environmental movement here in Illinois about marking a day of environmental education and activism during COVID-19. I'm Brian Mackey. That's just ahead on The 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. First, the news. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Today is Earth Day, the 50th anniversary. Later this hour, we'll have a conversation about marking a day of environmental education and activism amid the more urgent threat posed by a global pandemic. On that note, as we go to air Wednesday morning, Illinois is reporting more than 1,500 newly confirmed cases of COVID-19 and another 119 deaths. The coronavirus is now known to be in all but six of Illinois' 102 counties. And it's touched just about every part of our state, including its universities, which is what we'll be talking about in the first part of our show today. Hi there. How are you?
Good. Thanks. Can you hear me?
I can.
Good.
You sound pretty good. Yes.
That's good.
This is Tim Colleen. He's the president of the University of Illinois System. This is a time of year when campuses are usually filled with activity, but walk through Urbana-Champaign, Chicago, or Springfield today, and it's eerily empty. I spoke with Colleen via Zoom. He says working from home much of the time has allowed him to work on his guitar technique between meetings.
Etc. So you're the first person to see that, actually. Yeah.
Our conversation touches on the timeline of the university's response to the pandemic, whether furloughs or layoffs are coming, and whether students will return to campus for the fall semester. Before we get to that, I should note that Illinois Public Media, which produces The 21st, is part of the University of Illinois. That makes Colleen my boss's boss, and I might have missed a few layers in there. I work hard to make sure that doesn't affect how I conduct interviews, but you can judge for yourself. I began by asking Colleen when he first heard about the novel coronavirus.
Oh, I think I've been paying attention since the early reports from China in January. I think it goes back even further, but we've been paying attention since then and carefully looking at what was happening. Of course, the University of Illinois has got a lot of experts in all kinds of fields, healthcare delivery, virology, infectious disease specialists. But it definitely intensified, after the first cases were recorded in Seattle then, and by mid-March, we were very actively looking at implications.
Yeah. And I wondered, when did you get that sense that this might not just be something that happens in a remote part of China, but is actually might affect operations at the University of Illinois?
Oh yeah. Well, I tasked a task force in February actually, to look at the COVID-19, pandemic and to make recommendations. And that's led by our Vice Chancellor for Health Affairs in Chicago, Dr. Bob Barish, who's had a lot of experience dealing with emergency situations. And he put together a task team that's been meeting pretty much daily in direct contact with senior leadership. And of course, we're messaging continuously. So since February, we've been very actively engaged in preparing the university for likelihoods and what our students need. We put our students first and foremost in everything we do. But by mid-March, we were our epidemiological models were really demonstrating that we had to achieve this social distancing on an emergency basis.
Before we get to that point, on March 2nd, the university announces it's telling its students in Italy and South Korea to leave. And knowing as you did that China was affected in January and Italy was seeing outbreaks in February, did the university move quickly enough to tell those staff and students to come home?
Yeah, I think we've been on top of the evolution. Of course, it's been a infection that when it takes off extremely rapidly. So in a matter of days, if you one infected person infects several others, it can be an exponential. I think we were paying close attention and acting. We had a sequence of actions. As you know, we put in place travel restrictions, and then we brought students home, and took care of them individually. We had an initial limit on gathering size of about 50, and that was done very early, and then we reduced that to 10. And then, of course, everything happened in mid-March with Governor Pritzker mandating the stay-at-home situation that we're there now. So I think the university was paying close attention. We had our task force in place that was very experienced. We had several experts who knew what they were talking about, frankly, about this kind of respiratory disease and how it could explode in congested situations. So looking back at what we've done, of course, if we'd had a better crystal ball, maybe things could have been done earlier. But I'm very proud of the university's response, both in the precautionary steps we've taken, and in the response on research, on education, and on service, and influencing decision making at many levels. Mm-hmm. In fact, I obviously I'm biased in my role, but I'm extremely proud of the university's response on so many fronts. I think you'll be able to stack that up with any institutional response anywhere.
On March 11th, as we're sticking with this timeline, the university announced it would begin online classes to limit the transmission of COVID-19. And by March 16th, face-to-face instruction was canceled for the rest of the semester. Students were asked to move back to their permanent residence if they have one. And we got a question from someone on the internet message board Reddit asking, what changed so quickly from telling everyone to leave their stuff at school to requiring everyone to come and get their stuff and go home if they have one?
I think what was changing was the virulence of the disease and the transmission that was clearly happening. We had our own epidemiological experts who were assessing and predicting and so forth, and so there was no question that we had to react in a accelerating fashion during those days. It was a very intense period, I can tell you that. But we had all driven by science and data and our best knowledge and appreciation of past circumstances and what was happening in China. We looked carefully at what was happening in Italy, of course. And it was clear even then that that there could be explosive developments with certain events that could where there was so-called super spreaders, and so we really wanted to make sure that our community was as protected as possible and as informed as possible. And so you saw those multiple messages coming out during that interval.
And you mentioned consulting with experts. I wonder, can you tell me what sort of experts are you talking to? Are these university people? Are they outsiders?
Yeah, we're blessed at the University of Illinois with experts in almost any field that you can imagine. Obviously, biologists, microbiologists, biochemists. We have epidemiologists. We have a hospital in Chicago with all of the clinical. We've got 17 clinics. So we have very esteemed medical experts, and notably on infectious disease prevention and epidemiology. I think those two areas and emergency medicine all came into play, and they were all part of the task force. I was getting daily briefings, multiple briefings at different times, and so we were able to think through the implications of this, I think, at a relatively early stage and best prepare. Now, obviously, every one of those decisions that you've noted were not taken casually. They were all the product of careful thought and attention and a lot of discussion with those experts. But we have virologists, we have infectious disease specialists, and we have the medical community that we relied on heavily.
And what about the governor's office? The university's decision to move online for the remainder of the semester happened after the governor suspended elementary and high school attendance, but before the general stay-at-home order. And that same person on Reddit was asking if your decisions are coordinated with the governor's office, or are you on your own?
No, we coordinate tightly with the governor's office, and many conversations and calls in that interval. And in fact, we made some recommendations directly to the governor's office on in terms of the stay-at-home issue in that mid-March period that I would say we've got great leadership in Illinois. People are paying close attention there. And of course, we're a resource for the state. And so we're available, our experts were available. We made them available and we were in close, and we still are in very close contact with the state. As the major flagship university system.
Well, and since the time we've been talking about, summer classes have been moved online, campus events are canceled, and there's more I want to ask about what future semesters will look like, but let's put a pin in that for now. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Tim Killeen, the president of the University of Illinois system. The latest estimates from Governor J.B. Pritzker's administration say the pandemic could cause a $2.7 billion shortfall in tax collections just in the next few months, this budget year, with another $6 to $7.5 billion shortfall next year. How will the University of Illinois be affected by that?
Oh, I'd say we're directly affected by the state's budgetary situation. And of course, we receive funding from the state on an annual basis, approximately $600 million, which is very important for our operating funds within the university. We have multiple other sources of revenue, but as we remember from the 2016 budgetary impasse, that support mechanism is very important. So yes, we've been involved in that calculations too. We have about three dozen experts in finance and economics who have also been looking at the impact on the state's own budget, and we published a report on that front. We're going to be looking in even greater detail regionally and by sector, and we hope to sort of both inform the state on the economic impact and its implications, but also plan for recovery. And of course, we're all interested in recovery as soon as possible and minimizing the budgetary damage. But above everything else is our dedication to health and safety of the population. And that includes centrally our student body and our faculty and our staff and the communities in which the university is embedded. So yes, these are going to be challenging times. There's no question about that budgetarily. But as I hope you've noticed, the university is putting students first. And in fact, we have a new emergency fund for students that we call Students First. And that is designed to defray some of the emergency costs that some of the most needy students are encountering now, with maybe family members who've lost jobs, et cetera. So this is going to be a difficult passage. Economically, there's no question about that. We will do our part to help the state through this, both in terms of retaining its human capital, its ability to solve problems, and create the kind of safe environments that will enable the economy to recover, hopefully in an expeditious fashion. But yeah, those are big numbers. They're chastening numbers, no question about it.
Yeah, and specifically for the university, I saw a report in the Chicago Sun-Times last week that the U of I system expects to lose an estimated $158 million by June on account of the coronavirus. Where are those losses coming from?
They're coming from multiple sources, and we're paying very close attention to the additional costs. I mean, some of the things are obvious, events that would have been sponsored, even things like sporting events,
We have elected to refund students for housing and dining costs on a pro rata basis. If they're not able to take advantage of our dorms, we have returned those dollars. And that's itself is about a $35 million lost revenue source for the university. Things like, all the other facilities like parking and what we call auxiliaries, the recreation. But then there are things that we've had to do to transition to online education so quickly and so forcefully. We have purchased laptops for students who needed them. We've created hotspots for some students. Some of our students don't have good access to the internet. Then, of course, in the hospital setting, all the elective surgical procedures that have income associated with them have been stopped. So if you add it all up, it's a significant number. And of course, we're advocating strongly that the federal government also provides some relief to education writ large and to higher education in particular. And we're looking forward to some relief from the federal side. And then, of course, we hope that the partnership with the state can continue as robustly as possible into the future, because not only are we providing educational opportunities for our students in Illinois, but we're actually working hard to solve the problem of the coronavirus, both treatments, taking care of patients, and looking at things as prosaic as supplies and masks and swabs and ventilators and all of those things that that are needed to really step up to address this issue. So it's a challenging time, and we're deploying all of the assets of our university system on behalf of the state and our students.
We have been speaking with Tim Killeen, the president of the University of Illinois system. More to come after a break. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're going to continue our conversation with the University of Illinois System President, Tim Killeen. We've been talking about finances and how the coronavirus pandemic is expected to affect state finances, which will roll downhill and affect university finances. The University of Michigan on Monday announced cuts, which include reducing hours, pay, non-essential expenses. There are hiring and salary freezes, and the president there warned there could be deeper cuts to come, including layoffs. Do you see that happening at the University of Illinois?
Well, we have a whole range of options. We're looking at lots of scenarios. I don't really foresee those kind of things being announced anytime soon. We're paying very close attention to the evolution of the pandemic. I'm confident that we'll get back to face-to-face instruction in the fall, assuming that we keep our responsible social distancing in place. So we have scenarios that we've looked at all of those aspects. How would we lower our expenditures in order to offset these lost revenues? We're also working closely with the federal government and with the state government. So you will see announcements when we're ready to make them. But I would like to reassure the families and students of the University of Illinois system that we're there for them. We're not going anywhere. We're not going away. There'll be affordable, world-class quality educational opportunities going forward. And we will do it the best we can. Now, if that means a hybrid kind of circumstance where there's some distance modules, we don't have large classes, but we have many smaller classes. So we're looking at the adjustments that will be required to make into the future based on what we, the best science and the best data that's available at the time. So we are paying attention, obviously, to what other universities are doing and saying they're going to do. But we're in a path that we think is best for us to reassure our students that we're there for them, that these they're taking their classes, they're going to be taking exams shortly, and they'll be getting their degrees, and we're going to have virtual commencements, but then we're promising that we'll find a time to celebrate their accomplishments face-to-face as well. So we're not in this exactly the same position to make those statements, but we are looking at cost containment efforts, definitely, looking hard at that.
Well, on the question of cost, and this is a small cost in the grand scheme of things, but earlier this year, the Board of Trustees voted to give you a significant raise, moving your base salary and bonus of about $700,000 a year up to sort of rolling it into a salary of $853,000. Is that still going through despite the financial problems caused by the pandemic?
We haven't, brought that back to the governor at all. I've really been working flat out. I'm sure that and other things that are on the expenditure side will be looked at very carefully. Our first board meeting is coming up in May, and so that might be a consideration. I think other universities are looking at expenditures. We are working flat out at all levels, chancellors, deans, provosts, everybody, to do the best we can for our community. And that's our priority, frankly, right now. But thank you for raising that question.
And I just want to stick with it for one more moment, because when news of that broke, someone who identified themselves as a research assistant at the school tweeted angrily about it, saying they made $17,788 a year, which a chunk of that is taken back in fees, and they lose their health or they don't have health insurance in the summer. And meanwhile, student health insurance costs are going up at least $200 a semester this fall for undergraduate and graduate students in Urbana. Is there any consideration being given for that in the middle of a pandemic?
Yeah, we're looking at tuition for us incoming students. We found a way to defray the increment in tuition that we had planned. It was a subinflation increment of 1.8% for incoming in-state students next fall. We're going to find a way to defray those additional costs. On the healthcare side, we have contracts with outside health providers that we really need to look carefully at into the future. They're driven by the actual costs that our students take advantage of with their insurance and the number of students and all of the dynamics of the increasing cost on the health side. We're anxious to do the best we can to provide the maximum affordability. Right now, we're focusing on the most needy students, I would say, and we're doing that in multiple ways. We're finding these emergency funds. We announced just a few days ago at least $36 million will be found, including $1 million from my office, to offset some of the costs that the most needy students have that are facing sort of emergency issues in covering their costs. We are paying everybody. Nobody's been laid off or no furloughs. Even student workers who maybe have gone home to study now will be receiving their work study support as appropriate. So we're trying to do the best we can for everybody, recognizing that this is a big shock to the system, and a lot of families, a lot of employees are encountering difficult circumstances that are just not normal. So we do hear a lot of issues about individuals who are finding it difficult, international students who feel stuck where they can't get back, some students who don't have access to internet. We're trying to do the best we can for everybody involved. And I think the response of the university writ large has been magnificent. There's been very little complaining, very little, I can't do it that way. People have just jumped in and have been so supportive and very creative too. And as president, I want to set that tone that here, this is shared adversity, and groups like ours, institutions like ours, show their mettle when there's shared adversity. And we're doing
everything we can to help the state address this issue. We're looking after patients who have COVID-19. We're making sure we've got enough ventilators in our hospitals to take care of them. One good piece of news is that we have discharged over 400 patients who had COVID-19 and have now gone home. So we've also lost, double-digit numbers of patients who've unfortunately passed away from that disease. But we're working hard on the fronts of this. Our nurses, social workers, doctors, and all of the specialists are doing that. And then the engineers are working on ventilators that could be deployed in situations where, emergency ventilators and also 3D printing of masks. So the whole response of the system has been nothing short of magnificent. And of course, we're also working on treatments, including doing clinical trials. So all of that work is taking place too. We're conducting 3 clinical trials on potential treatments that would have positive benefits for patients, including the Ebola drug, which we've already reported the results of those clinical trials back to NIH. Also a rheumatoid arthritis drug, and we're looking at the role of statins and posture. So we're taking care of patients as well, and we're working closely with the regional hospitals. And we're frankly helping the state develop the whole manifold of testing that needs to be applied so that the incidents can be tracked, and when it's determined that somebody has an infection, that the appropriate displacement and quarantine situations are in place. So that means quarantining students if they get symptoms as well. So we're working hard on the testing and beefing that up across the state.
I'm glad you mentioned testing because I should say we're talking with University of Illinois President Tim Killeen here on the 21st. And I want to move to what's next for the university and for the state. And you mentioned testing. You mentioned the number of people being discharged. We got a question emailed to us from Joe, a University of Illinois alum. She writes, "It seems there's a growing divide about what should happen next. Some elected officials say we need to get back to work and restart the economy, while others say continued social distancing is necessary until we have better testing, contact tracing, medical capacity, etc. What are your metrics for deciding when students, faculty, and staff can safely return to campus? And how will you decide when the University of Illinois reopens?"
We're gonna basically decide on the basis of data, science, and quantitative understanding. What's clear is that the social distancing that was implemented under Governor Pritzker's leadership in the state of Illinois is working. It is bending the curve. That's the phrase that people use. There are many fewer deaths than would have occurred otherwise if the exponential takeoff had been allowed to happen. Now, that needs to continue until we get the epidemic under sufficient control that there's no danger that the hospitals will be overwhelmed. I think that's a very important consideration, and it can be looked at quantitatively with the best modeling and the analysis of data and so forth. And right now we are in the position that the hospitals do have enough ventilators and enough equipment to take care of the current patients. It's under stress, there's no question about that. People on the front lines are working hard. But if there were to be a significant relaxation too soon, then the virus doesn't care. It can go back to accelerating, and there is there's a special number that you look at, which is sometimes called R0, which is the number of people that an infected individual infects. And if that number is greater than 1, that means that you can get significant rapid growth in the prevalence of the disease in a big population. So we've pushed through this dose social distancing with all the sacrifices involved to get that number to be below 1, we believe, to the point that the epidemic in Illinois is now going to diminish, but it's going to be a long haul. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to have to be paying close attention to that. the onset of this thing goes up faster than the decline, which is a slower decline. And so we're looking hard at that and the implications for the university. We want to make sure that when our students, if and when our students are back, and I'm confident, as I said earlier, that they will return in the fall semester, that we have all of the appropriate, at the time appropriate, protocols in place to make sure that sufficient social distancing is in place to avoid that number getting much bigger than one, which then would immediately or quickly start to place hospitals and our healthcare system under more significant stress. So we don't want a second surge, that's for sure, because then it'll take even longer to get back. So these are all things that don't have to be based on hunches. They can be based on the analysis of data and our understanding of how this virus is transmitted. We don't have a full understanding of that, but we've got some empirical data from other countries and also our own data now that we can look at carefully. So what I can reassure people is we will be at the best possible stance in terms of all the protocols in place to do the best job we can for our educational mission. And in so doing, we'll be supporting the state in getting back. So I think this will be a significant long haul still. We're not talking about next week or the week after. And we've got to pay really close attention to the transmissibility of the disease. And that includes understanding things like, do asymptomatic individuals, are they carriers, and to what extent is there sort of hidden transmission of the disease? We need to get a better handle on that. Sure. All of this will be facilitated by testing.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, we just a couple of minutes left in our conversation here, and we did get another question emailed from Adam, a third-year physics major at the University of Illinois, who said, I've heard the rumor that classes in the fall will be remote. Students will have the option to pause their degree. He asks if there's any truth there. Now, I know you've just said that you're confident that there will be in-person classes with social distancing, but what do you say to students who might be considering, you know, maybe now is the time to look at a gap year?
Yeah, thanks for the question. And I was once a third degree physics student. So my initial advice is we don't just take a rumor as gospel. Do ask the question that you're asking. We're trying to be very forthright and honest in all of the communications, and we have websites up that people can look at. There are some questions that it's impossible to answer categorically right now, because we just don't know what's going to happen, you know, precisely in the next few months. So we'll base it on the best science and the best data that we're assembling, and we're heavily involved in all of that. So we'll keep people informed. If we're able to maintain suppression the way it looks like we are now, there will be a reduction in the number of new cases. There'll be a reduction in the hospitalizations, and there'll be some. And we need to keep that going, and that'll transpire over months, a couple of months, and we'll get to the point where the outbreak can be more managed. Which will allow us to return to more normal circumstances. So I think if the question about gap years, I mean, that's a personal decision, of course. We just want to let you know that we're going to be there for you to finish your studies with world-class capabilities and to be very proud of your degree. And we will offer it at the best in the best possible manner, and, you know, state-of-the-art manner, taking advantage of our brilliant faculty capabilities, including our distance education capabilities, and then maybe some hybrid models of that to ensure that we don't get back to a resurgence situation.
Tim Killeen is the president of the University of Illinois System. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you for your interest, and thank you for your work.
Stay well.
You too.
Coming up on the 21st, today is Earth Day. It's the 50th anniversary. We're going to have a conversation about how you mark a day of environmental education and activism amid a more urgent threat posed by the global COVID-19 pandemic. That conversation is just ahead. And tomorrow on the program, we're planning to bring you a conversation with Lenore Skenazy. She's been thinking and writing about fostering independence in children since long before there was a global pandemic. If you've learned something about parenting during the stay-at-home orders, we'd love to hear about it. Send us an email or voice memo to talk at 21stshow.org. That's talk at 21stshow.org. More to come after a break. Stay with us. I'm Brian Mackey. This is the 21st. This is Earth Day, and this is, well...
This is a CBS News special. Earth Day, a question of survival, with CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite.
Good evening. A unique day in American history is ending, a day set aside for a nationwide outpouring of mankind seeking its own survival. Earth Day.
That was Walter Cronkite from CBS Evening News speaking on the first Earth Day in 1970. It's usually celebrated with large gatherings in many cities to raise consciousness about the state of the planet, as Cronkite reported. He also noted this about the people who made it out on that first Earth Day.
Its demonstrators were predominantly young, predominantly white, predominantly anti-Nixon. Often its protests appeared frivolous, its protesters curiously carefree. Yet the gravity of the message of Earth Day still came through. Act or die.
Things are different 50 years on, with public gathering banned on account of the coronavirus pandemic, but people are finding other ways to reflect on the state of our planet. Environmental advocacy groups say this unprecedented Earth Day is also an opportunity to assess legislative priorities and what we need to do to tackle other global problems like climate change and environmental inequality. Joining us now is Jen Walling, Executive Director of the Illinois Environmental Council in Springfield. And also with us is Jack Darin, Director of the Illinois Chapter of the Sierra Club. Jen, Jack, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Great to be with you, Brian.
And you can also join the conversation if you're listening now. How do you plan to mark Earth Day in Illinois? Give us a call at 800-222-9455. That number again is 800-222-9455. Jack, I want to begin with you. This is, I think, a strange time to be celebrating the 50th anniversary of Earth Day during a global pandemic. How has that shaped what the Illinois chapter of the Sierra Club is thinking about on Earth Day this year?
Well, of course, our thoughts really are with the crisis and those most at risk. And as a volunteer-based organization, we've been spending a lot of time, like most of us have been, in video chats and staying in touch with each other. And it's been great and reassuring to see that the people care about and who work so hard are healthy, but also still engaged in wanting to find a way that they can make a difference, not only for the environmental priorities we were working so hard on a month or so ago, but also standing up for the people who are most at risk from this health crisis.
And Jen, what about you? Same question. How is the Environmental Council marking Earth Day and thinking about it this year?
I think the same as what Jack is bringing up. A lot of our actions have moved to things that are on social media and online, connecting via video calls, and placing more importance than ever on making sure our staff, our volunteers, the community are taking care of themselves and their families. We're working on the same things, but our priorities are different now.
So, Jen, I understand your organization was founded a few years after the first Earth Day in 1970, and obviously Earth Day is about raising consciousness about the state of the planet. I'm wondering about the state of Illinois. How do you think Illinois is doing when it comes to environmental health or protecting environmental health?
Well, I think that we've come a long way. And yeah, IEC was formed by some of the individuals in Illinois that led the Earth Day efforts in 1970, including groups like the Sierra Club that Jack now leads. And I think that We have come a long way, and there's measurable progress in environmental quality that literally you can see, but we're still working on some of the same things. I think that in 1970, they were advocating for the creation of an environmental agency. Today, we're advocating for the IEPA and other agencies that have been cut in half over the last decade. And those cuts to the environmental agencies have put us in this position where we are today, where we can't deal with catastrophes, we can't enforce environmental laws. So there are, we've done a lot, but there's still a lot of work that we need to do to make sure that public health is protected.
Now, Jack, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what progress we have made in Illinois since 1970. What, and of course, the Illinois Constitution, I think that year actually added the environmental protection to the state's Bill of Rights. Can you talk a little bit about what Illinois' environment might have looked like in 1970? What were the urgent issues back then?
Well, I mean, at that point, we didn't have our most basic federal environmental laws that unfortunately now really are being questioned by the current federal administration. So we had, you know, raw sewage flowing into our Great Lakes and our rivers and streams. We didn't have regulations on pesticides and toxic chemicals. We weren't being very aggressive about saving habitats for biodiversity. And I think we really can all look back and be proud of what we've accomplished over the last 50 years. There are environmental problems that we've made great progress on, if not largely solved. Problems like acid rain, problems like lead in our air from lead in gasoline. We're taking species off the endangered and threatened species list and seeing them recover. So we absolutely have crises like climate change and emerging pollutants that we need to address. But if we look back on the fact that when we set our minds to it as a society, we have solved problems and we can do it again, and we're going to need to.
I think for a lot of us, Earth Day is something that we associate with school science classes. Before the show, the producers and I were talking about some of the different environmental lessons we all learned on Earth Day and how that changes from generation to generation. In the 70s, somebody recalled pollutants that we were putting into the earth, dirty water, things like that. Then it was fixing the ozone. In the 90s, I remember an emphasis on recycling. So what are the Earth Day lessons being taught right now, Jack?
Well, right now, in the midst of this crisis, I think that, you know, we see some parallels between what we need to do to protect ourselves and recover from the coronavirus pandemic and challenges like climate change. And two really basic things we've got to do to solve both of those are to listen to science and let facts and not politics or fear guide our actions, and also to stand up for the people who are most at risk. Because unfortunately, the folks out there right now who are most at risk from this health crisis are the same ones who are being disproportionately impacted by pollution and stand to be impacted by climate change more than any of us. So if we learn to do both those things, then I'm confident that we can come out of both of these, the pandemic and the climate crisis, stronger and more connected and a more just society.
Jen, I want to ask you the same question. What do you think the Earth Day lessons are being taught now? Maybe even not just in the pandemic, but, you know, this generation of students.
Well, I think this generation of students is teaching us and not the other way around. I think that this generation of students is more motivated than ever to tackle climate change. This is something that students, young students today, know that this is something that's going to impact them in their lifetime, and they're terrified. And they see the urgency of this issue. We've seen so much action with the youth climate strikes, and even today on a national basis, there is a 72-hour live stream of youth climate strike. And tonight at 6 to 7, the Illinois group is going to be part of that national stream. And I just think that there's so many ways that those students and what they're doing and the urgency that they're bringing is motivating the rest of us to work harder and do more, because this is really a crisis that is going to impact them more than anybody else alive. So I'm definitely learning lessons from what they're doing, how they're organizing, and the enthusiasm that they're bringing to something that is impacting all of us.
Jen, I want to talk to you a little bit about policy. We sat down, I don't know, 2-3 months ago in the Environmental Council's Springfield offices and talked about the Clean Energy Jobs Act and some of the other policy priorities of your organization this spring. That feels like it was a few years ago, frankly. And that was going to be one of the big issues that everybody was focusing on in Springfield this year. And the goal is to switch Illinois over to 100% renewable energy by 2050. We're not really sure when legislators are going to return to Springfield. We don't really know what they're going to do. It could be a pretty pared-down legislative session. What is the status of the Clean Energy Jobs Act?
Well, I think that it's in flux, just like everything else that might be happening with the legislative session. I mean, we assume that a number of our bills just won't be called this year, but the Clean Energy Jobs Act is still a priority. And we've been working on educating lawmakers on the things that are part of that that will assist with the recovery, but also, if they're not going past, are going to make things more problematic. So there's a solar jobs cliff that, while we're going through all of these economic issues, the addition of all of these solar companies hitting an area where they're not being funded and losing jobs will make the economic situation worse. Or the FERC order from the federal government is one that will increase rates for consumers. So there are a number of ways that not passing the Clean Energy Jobs Act will make things worse. And I also think that we need a renewed emphasis on pollution reduction overall. And I think that for us, CEJA is still a priority, but we're working more on the prioritization of the impacts of low-income people, workers, and public health, because those are the things that are most urgent right now.
And Jack, same question to you. Does the Sierra Club have a legislative agenda that was sort of moved aside this year, I imagine? Or what is the status of what you were hoping to see out of Springfield in just a couple of minutes we have left?
Working very closely with Jen on the Clean Energy Jobs Act, she talked about that's really critical. We know that there's an economic component, obviously a massive one, to this pandemic. We had towns across central Illinois already hurting from fossil fuel plant retirements. And we think the state increases, the urgency is increased for the state to help those workers and help those communities. It's just another reason why passing bold clean energy legislation really needs to be part of our response to this crisis.
You know, as I've been thinking about the pandemic and how unprepared we really seem to be, I mean, this is a big issue. There have been books written about, you know, the emerging threats of viruses jumping from animals to humans. There have been, you know, policy symposia about this. People knew about these sort of things, and yet we were utterly unprepared, and it has crippled our economy, and it's happened so quickly. And I wonder if you see a parallel there to the way we seem to, as a collective people, be it Illinoisans or Americans or the human race, seem to be having such a hard time wrapping our brains around the threat of climate change. Do you see a parallel there, Jen? Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are a ton of different lines of thought in why this is very comparable. I think that, I talked a little bit about the scaling back of government agencies, both at the state level and the federal level, that I think have left us unprepared for this pandemic, will leave us unprepared for other catastrophic events. And that's been a systematic and purposeful scaling back of those government agencies that have left us here. And I think similarly, scientists have brought forward these potential risks and we haven't listened. And both with climate change and these public health risks. And scientists do anticipate that the impacts of pandemics will be worse with climate change, both new pandemics from the melting of ice caps, but also changes in climate that may make different diseases worse and more spreadable. So I think that there's definitely parallels in how this works. And just reminding us that, you know, despite how much we want to do whatever we want, we're all connected. That's both what Earth Day is about and what we're realizing more intimately than ever through the pandemic.
And Jack, just about 20 seconds left in our conversation, but are you optimistic that the experience we're going through now with this pandemic will sort of change the way people think about the threat to the environment?
I am. I think that we're going to come out of this thinking more strongly than we have in a long time, that listening to the scientists and health professionals matter, and that we need institutions like government to lead and protect us, and we need each other most of all.
Jack Darin is president of the Illinois chapter of the Sierra Club, or I should say director of the Illinois chapter of the Sierra Club, and Jen Walling is director of the Illinois Environmental Council. Happy Earth Day. Stay well. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you. Happy Earth Day.
Thank you, Brian.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Our producers are Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpison is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director, and we have a special thank you, as always, to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Mackey. We'll be back with another show tomorrow. Thanks for listening to The 21st.